Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And here's a question. When was the last time somebody really enjoyed being a leader of the House or the Senate? Reveled in the power and politics of being majority leader of the Senate or Speaker of the House of Representatives. You might have to go back to 1983 and this guy, who seemed to be having the time of his life.
You know, you look a little like Tip O'Neill.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people say that. Really, I'm a better looking fellow than he is.
Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House of Representatives, Congressman from Massachusetts on the TV sitcom Cheers, February 17th, 1983. O'Neill's gusto for his job and his prestige and charisma made him a pop culture figure, even at a time when the 80s Congress was the butt of jokes.
What were you saying last week about that do-nothing Congress down there in D.C.?
They're a bunch of clowns.
Hey, you think so, huh?
Yeah, you could take the average guy off the street and you could do a better job.
Nah.
Sure. This bozo right here could probably be a better congressman than them.
Oh, yeah?
You're out of work, too, huh?
No, I'm a Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Can you imagine a leader in the Congress today getting a laugh like that? Boehner, Reid, cameos on House of Cards, Game of Thrones, perhaps? Not likely. This hour, a look at the lost prestige and troubled system of leadership in the House and Senate. Also, we see a 21st century Cuban Missile Crisis brewing in the Panama Canal, but only North Korea may have to duck and cover this time. Also, the albums of summer. We look at the summer music of 1993. A summer of musical nirvana in more ways than one. Little thinking in the box there, I'd say. But first, another day, another cliffhanger in the U.S. Senate. A deal patched together to allow up and down votes on some long-stalled presidential appointments. The White House had to deliver a compromise on two of its appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, a popular whipping boy for Republicans. And Republican John McCain delivered some Republican votes in a deal that ends up preserving the filibuster. That all happened yesterday under a Democratic threat to change Senate rules by majority party line vote and actually gut the 60-vote filibuster rule. You know, the old nuclear option. Didn't happen. Deal averted. The disaster, the nuclear option. Here's Majority Leader Harry Reid in remarks yesterday on Capitol Hill.
I hope that everyone learned the lesson last night, that it sure helps to sit down and talk to each other.
Not exactly the sound of a powerful bull charging ahead there in the Senate. And what of the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner?
My job is to do everything I can to facilitate a process for solving this problem. And that's what I'm going to continue to do.
Speaker of the House, maybe he's facilitator of the House, John Boehner, talking last week cagily about immigration reform, a real challenge for the House of Representatives. Let's bring in Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick and Jennifer Senior, who recently profiled Representative Boehner for New York Magazine. Todd and Jennifer, welcome.
Hi.
Hello. Hi.
So, Todd, you know, is it my impression? I mean, both of you can, leave a boot print on my face if you like. But it seems to me this whole leadership system in the House and Senate is in a state of extraordinary dysfunction. Harry Reid, is he having any fun up there? Is there any power reflected in what happened yesterday? Am I wrong here, Todd?
Well, you know, John, the Senate isn't really designed for leaders to have an extraordinary amount of power. Ever since the leadership of a guy who loved being leader, Lyndon Johnson, we expect Senate leaders to have a lot of power, and they do have more than they used to. But with the 60-vote threshold, even though, as we all know, that's used a lot more than it used to, you know, Harry Reid doesn't have a gavel. And neither does Mitch McConnell, not symbolically, not figuratively, not at all. And there's a reason for that, because people like John McCain can, if they can get the support of enough people, just go around them. McCain did it this week. McCain helped do it in 2005 with the Gang of 14. Same deal. They didn't ask for permission. They just went around him. And with enough votes, you can do it. The House is a very different place in that way.
Well, am I wrong in saying that the way the Senate works, and you've just described it there, it's actually the minority leader in under the 60-vote rule who has more power, because he's more able, or she is more able, to actually shut things down than the majority leader is to get things done.
The minority leader has more power to slow things down and would want to if his or her party isn't in the White House, of course, to block legislation. But don't forget about the enormous power that Harry Reid, as leader, has to set the agenda. He decides which bills come. He decides when. He decides in what order. And increasingly, to the consternation of Republicans, decides how many amendments and on what. Part of the nuclear option fight is Harry Reid's fault. Don't fool yourself to think it's all obstruction from Mitch McConnell and the other Republicans. Part of it does come from Harry Reid, and that is a very strong hand that he has, setting the agenda, what, where, and when.
All right, so he can write the Senate's dance card, even if he can't deliver votes in the way that Lyndon Johnson used to. That's the story in the Senate. Jennifer Senior, John Boehner, it seems to me, is really under a pretty significant test on immigration reform here. Can he deliver something that it would seem from the 2012 election the Republicans really need here? Jennifer?
They need it. I don't think enough of them. I mean, if you ask me, I don't think that they're going to deliver it. I think that too many of them are not thinking long term. They're thinking short term. And in their own districts, not only does immigration not matter much, but they are terribly afraid in many, many cases of having somebody challenge them from the right, who would be much more anti-immigration than they are. And that, to me, I think they're going to weigh their own self-interest against the party's, you know, larger interest. And I mean, who do you think is going to win that one?
Is Boehner in that situation? I mean, is he in a vulnerable district in the sense that someone could challenge him from the right if he advocates immigration reform?
Well, it's interesting. It's doubtful. I mean, people really like him in his district, and he's in a very safe district, as many of these people are. But it's funny, the Club for Growth and, you know, American Heritage for Action Committee, I guess it is, they are these kind of right-wing groups that are, or these conservative groups, I should say, that are now in the business of running challengers to lots of Boehner's brain trust. I mean, they'll do it to like his best friends if they don't do it to him. So, I mean, he's slowly but surely going to lose his allies in Congress if he's not careful. I mean, I can isolate a couple of them who are already facing challenges, and it's not pretty.
And here you've characterized a John Boehner, Speaker of the House, under threat, not a Sam Rayburn kind of character who really pretty much holds all the cards. And of course, the House rules are very different today than they were in Sam Rayburn's time. But is John Boehner, based on your experience and your reporting, Jennifer Senior, having any fun?
No. I mean, if you ask all of his allies, again, I mean, it's so unequivocal. If you ask any of his allies, they will say that they think he's got the hardest job. I mean, they'll sort of acknowledge that Obama has the hardest job in Washington, sure, but they'll sort of say that probably Boehner has the least pleasant one. He's facing, it's when you're facing opposition from the other party, you sort of understand it. You know where it's coming from. It doesn't feel like a betrayal. When opposition is kind of surging up from within your own ranks, it's really a drag. And that's what's going on right now.
Well, to both of you, then, it seems to me from Tom Daschle to Harry Reid and from, you know, the successor to Tip O'Neill, Jim Wright of Texas, all the way to John Boehner, we've had essentially failed majority leaderships and dubious speakerships in all cases, ending badly, not projecting the kind of power that was intended by the designers of this congressional system. Is it in flames right now, Todd Zwillich?
I think that's really, boy, John, that's a really tough question and an interesting one to contemplate. I'm gonna go against you and with one speaker and say Nancy Pelosi, judged around the Capitol to have been a highly successful speaker. Things like, not that all these things became law, climate change did not become law. Nancy Pelosi's ability to pass it in a House and among Democrats that didn't want to take that vote, her whipping ability was remarkable. The Affordable Care Act, which is law and probably will be a lot more popular 10 years from now than it is now, a remarkable legislative achievement, which Nancy Pelosi deserves an extraordinary amount of credit for. And around the Capitol, even among Republicans in private moments, she is respected and feared. So Nancy Pelosi, I think, will go down as a successful speaker. John Boehner is not
in danger of losing in his district. John Boehner is in danger of losing his speakership if he goes too far with things like fiscal deals and immigration.
Jennifer, would people make an argument that as effective as Pelosi was in the circumstances of having the majority that she had and the Senate behind her as well and the presidency, that she should have accomplished more in an ideal speakership sort of scenario?
I doubt that. I think passing Obama's healthcare plan was pretty hard. I mean, and I think that, you know, I opened my piece this week with the Club for Growth head, and the Club for Growth, as I said, is a very conservative group, expressing his admiration for her and saying that she was willing to lose her speakership over it, right? Because, I mean, getting that thing passed didn't turn out to be particularly popular. They lost the majority. And she did it. And I think that takes a lot of courage. And I think that the difference between her temperamentally and somebody like John Boehner is that she's a lot of these things that speakers should be. She's got a vision. She's an ideologue. She's kind of inspirational when she speaks. She can be a kneecapper when she wants to be. She can be really tough.
All right. Well, then is the consensus here, despite my concern about the system itself, that it's really much more dependent on the character in that position of leadership than it is the system at this point? And eventually we'll find a majority leader and another speaker who has the kind of power that we've been talking about. Todd first and then Jennifer.
John, Tip O'Neill, Sam Rayburn, the speakers that you sort of revel in the past who were effective leaders, presided over a House that wasn't divided, over a national electorate that was extremely Democratic. The problem today, I think, is not with the quality of their leadership. It is the division among the electorate and in the country, and the division in the House and Senate, bordering at times on ungovernable. That's the issue.
Final thought, Jennifer?
I agree with that, and I think also Boehner has a Twitter problem. He's got a conservative PAC problem, where if people oppose him, they become folk heroes. They're like the Rand. It's the Rand Paul phenomenon, and that makes it very hard in this day and age to lead.
Jennifer Senior, a writer for New York Magazine, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks to both of you.
Pleasure, John.
Thank you.
So the George Zimmerman acquittal produced a lot of conversation about the state of Florida on the show this week. One Sunshine State defender wanted to remind us all that his home is a lot more than just show trials and political gridlock.
This is George from Orlando, Florida. They're not characterizing Florida. The reality is it's a great place. There's a lot of great things to do and see here. The people here are good, helpful, law-abiding citizens for the most part.
Thanks, George, listening to us on WLRN in Miami, one of many to call us on 877-8-MY-TAKE. Later this hour, we're taking you back to the songs of the summer 20 years ago.
Erin Andress from Orlando, Florida. It was the summer before I left for college, and I was entranced by Pearl Jam, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Jane's Addiction. These bands seemed to me so worldly, so gritty, so adventurous, and that's just what I wanted to be at almost 18 and with all of my choices ahead of me.
Nice. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. And next, the comings and goings of Cuba.
All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, where they're found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back.
50 years ago, JFK inspected ships on their way to Cuba for Soviet weapons. Coming up, a story of ships leaving Cuba with weapons. A new Cuban missile crisis coming up here on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Well, you can't sugarcoat this one, even though the Cubans have apparently tried. Panamanian officials are holding a North Korean freighter reported to be carrying a missile system on board buried in sacks and crates of sugar picked up in Cuba. The Panamanian president called the Cuban cargo sophisticated missile equipment. The vessel's 35 crew members were taken into custody, and there are reports that the North Korean captain tried to commit suicide. The shipments violate numerous international sanctions against North Korea. Cuban officials called the weapons obsolete Soviet-era hardware on their way to being repaired in North Korea. Why you'd want to repair obsolete hardware? Nevertheless, even if they were being repaired, it would still be a violation of embargo agreements. On the line with us now is Hugh Griffiths, an international arms trafficking expert at the Stockholm International Peace
Research Institute. Welcome, Hugh.
Hi, John.
So how significant is this find, and what do you make of Cuba getting into this game? It's certainly not the first time.
It's very interesting if you're interested in North Korean clandestine trading patterns, and indeed if you have an interest in what's going on in Cuba.
Now, the pictures that I saw, there were a couple that were tweeted out by, I believe, Panamanian authorities, indicate there was an antenna from a anti-aircraft battery, a Soviet SA-2, I believe, anti-aircraft battery. What kind of capability are we talking about here based on the details we have?
Well, Havana isn't lying when they're saying this is pretty outdated technology by Western standards. What's really important to note is what else was in the hold of that ship. There were missile components destined for repair in North Korea, but there was also a great deal of sugar. This was really barter trade. This was the Cubans sending something that they have in great quantities, sugar, to the North Koreans, who have no sugar and are desperately hungry, and it's a famine-ravaged country. And in exchange, the North Koreans were going to repair and possibly upgrade these slightly obsolete missile components. So that's what you see going on here, topped off with a classic piece of diplomacy involving certainly the most isolated regime in the world, the Pyongyang, with one of its few international partners in Havana. And these guys, you know, their cooperation has been moved to a higher level earlier this month through the visit of the North Korean Army Chief of Staff, meeting, among others, Raul Castro in Havana. So you can see this seizure within that context, and you get a fascinating glimpse into how goods are moved in a clandestine fashion.
Well, you know, it's interesting because what you're saying there actually causes me to believe that it makes sense that the Cubans are being fairly candid about all this. Here's Rafael Serrano, who's the host of Cuban State Television, issuing a government statement, essentially confirming all of this and giving a rationale. Listen.
The agreements signed by Cuba in this area are based on the need to maintain our defense capability and protect our national sovereignty. The Republic of Cuba reiterates its firm and irrevocable commitment to peace, disarmament, including nuclear disarmament, and respects international law.
On some level, Hugh Griffiths, it seems like you're viewing this transaction, this discovery, as more an incident of trade between North Korea and Cuba rather than some military exchange that's going to up the ante in either country.
Well, I think, yes. Well, I think what that Cuban gentleman was trying to do was trying to defuse the situation, because he was trying to get away from the idea that these missile components were connected to any weapons of mass destruction, WMD program, or ballistic missile technology that could be used, you know, to threaten states such as Japan or even, you know, the west coast of the U.S., which is the primary concern with North Korea. But nevertheless, it doesn't respect international law, this transfer, because it's definitely a violation of the UN arms embargo, albeit a less serious one than could have been the case had it involved, you know, ballistic missile technology involved in creating equipment, missiles that could hit Japan or carry a nuclear payload or that kind of thing. So the Koreans are really trying to limit the damage here.
Well, perhaps the strategic value of this discovery, though, lies in some other of the details that I mentioned earlier, the alleged suicide attempt by the captain, the notion that this might be a barter, as you have suggested. It does seem to indicate a level of desperation on the part of North Korea for commodities like sugar at this point. And does that suggest that the West perhaps has an opportunity for really, you know, delivering some clout in its negotiations with the North Korea on nuclear matters?
That would normally be the case, what you've just enunciated. The problem is that the North Korean elite, the leadership, would rather their people starve than be perceived as being weak, which might threaten their domestic position back home. What's a bit surprising is that this ship would sail into the U.S.'s backyard in a fashion that raises all kinds of red flags for, say, not only agencies such as, you know, the U.S. Office of Naval Intelligence, but, you know, United States Coast Guard, U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. I mean, it's there's so many risk indicators, and there's a lot of suspect behavior surrounding this ship. It's pretty much amateur hour on one level.
Hugh Griffiths, the head of Countering Illicit Trafficking Mechanism Assessment Project at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, commenting on the level of surprise and desperation possibly suggested by the discovery of a Cuban shipload of weapons in a North Korean ship taken custody of in the Panama Canal. Hugh Griffiths, thanks so much.
You're welcome, John.
We've invited you to step back 20 years in time using music as your time machine.
My name is Paolo Culler from Miami, and my summer song was the Chronic album by Dr. Dre in 1993.
Over on Facebook, Claire from Dallas wrote to us, 1993 was Counting Crows' first album, August and Everything After, on a constant loop. I can remember. Around here, isn't that how it went? Something like that? Jen from Massachusetts writes, Love Is by Vanessa Williams and Brian McKnight. If I'd had it on tape, I would have worn it right out. I'll take my chances that it's not too late. We never get worn out hearing from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Thrill and agony in the sports world now. First, some thrill from last night's baseball All-Star game.
When I got to the mound, I see both teams out of the dugout and cheering and applauding there. That was amazing.
The thrill of victory there for Mariano Rivera of the New York Yankees, who pitched a 3-up, 3-down eighth inning last night and brought 45,000 people to their feet to honor one of the truly unblemished and beloved people in sports. The American League won the All-Star game, by the way. As for the agony,
performance-enhancing drugs, whatever they are, affect the performance on the field. And that is not what this sport is about, or any sport should be about.
That's baseball commissioner, a definitely not unblemished and beloved person, Bud Selig, on the David Letterman Show this week, agonizingly trying to dodge tawdry allegations of more performance-enhancing drug use in baseball, the possibility of some very high-profile suspensions, including Yankee Alex Rodriguez. Baseball says suspensions in the latest doping scandal won't happen until next year, pending investigations. And there's a similar thrill and agony narrative stalking the world of Jamaican runners. Over the weekend, two more medal-winning Jamaican sprinters admitted to doping, bringing the total to 5. And that puts the spotlight on the fastest man in the world, Usain Bolt. Joining us now to talk about all this is Ellis Cashmore, professor of culture, media, and sport at Staffordshire University in the UK, author of Making Sense of Sports. Ellis, welcome.
Thanks, John. Glad to be there.
You know, it seems to me, looking at these Jamaican sprinters and Major League Baseball, that there's a sense of inevitability here about testing results or the results of investigations. I mean, is all this inevitable for baseball players and, dare I say, maybe even for, as far as we know, Mr. Squeaky Clean himself, Usain Bolt?
I think so, but be careful what you say, John. Usain Bolt is a clean athlete. He has never registered a negative test. I think you're getting confused with Tyson Gay, the American athlete, and Asafa Powell, who is one of a number of Jamaican athletes who have recorded positive dope tests in recent days. But nevertheless, your point is a strong one, and that is that it casts a shadow, not simply over athletics, track and field, and baseball, but cycling, swimming, really the whole kaleidoscope of sports across the world. And I think now there is no doubt about it that athletes have made it signally clear that they do intend to use performance-enhancing dope, no matter what. Year after year, we have additional penalties, ever more draconian laws against drug taking, and yet periodically, we see athletes, not just any old athletes, but the world's elite athletes who are cropping up and, if not confessing, saying, well, we can't figure out how this kind of untoward substance got in our system. And so they're putting their hands up. I think this is important, and you'll have to indulge me a second, John, but I don't think any athlete is consciously trying to cheat when they take dope. I think that they are trying to restore a level playing field. I think that they realize that doping is so widespread in whatever sport they're in that the only way to compete in sport at the elite level in the 21st century is to take some form of enhancing dope.
Well, then, given that, does that make it hard for someone like Usain Bolt, who has an unblemished record, but increasingly in our time, the idea of being clean and successful is more and more outlandish?
I think it is. And I think Bolt finds himself in the kind of position that Lance Armstrong would have been in 2003, 2005, around that era, that is utterly dominant in a sport where people are looking at so many other athletes and thinking, are they clean or are they on something? Now, Bolt is above that at the moment, and let's hope it remains that way. But I think he cannot help but escape a few inferences and suspicions, etc.
Ellis Cashmore is professor of culture, media, and sport at Staffordshire University in the UK and the author of Making Sense of Sports. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And yesterday, Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, Prosecutor-in-Chief of the United States, you might say, weighed in on the George Zimmerman verdict, the possibility of new federal charges in the Trayvon Martin shooting, and he criticized Florida's stand-your-ground laws.
It's time to question laws that senselessly expand the concept of self-defense and sow dangerous conflict in our neighborhoods. These laws try to fix something that was never broken.
It was a wide-ranging speech before the NAACP in Orlando, Florida, yesterday. Holder also restated a commitment by the Justice Department to maintain vigilance on voting rights even after the recent Supreme Court decision striking down the formula for monitoring certain districts with a history of voting rights abuses.
The Justice Department will continue to monitor jurisdictions around the country for any changes that may hamper voting rights. We will not hesitate to take aggressive action against any jurisdiction that attempts to take advantage of the Supreme Court's ruling by hindering eligible citizens' free and fair exercise of the franchise.
But unless Congress acts, the Justice Department's hands are tied somewhat, and Chief Justice Roberts invited Congress to take action in his opinion on the Voting Rights Act last month. Our country has changed, he wrote, and while any racial discrimination in voting is too much, Congress must ensure that the legislation it passes to remedy that problem speaks to current conditions. The Senate Judiciary Committee holds hearings today on just such congressional remedies. Joining us now is Heather Gerken, professor at Yale Law School, where she specializes in election law. She joins us from her home in New Haven. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
So what should we look for in this Senate hearing in terms of gauging Congress's seriousness in actually trying to take Chief Justice Roberts at his word and come up with a new formula?
Well, my guess is what we'll see in the hearings is an effort to show that this is something that ought to have bipartisan support. So you notice that the two lead witnesses are Congressman John Lewis, who is, of course, a civil rights icon, and Congressman Sensenbrenner, who was the Republican who pushed through the renewal of the Voting Rights Act in 2006. So I'm assuming that the main focus here will be that we can do this in a bipartisan fashion and that this is something that ought to matter to all Americans.
So you've got Lewis and Sensenbrenner depicting this sort of bipartisanship, which is essential for any serious action to happen here. And a lot of people after the Supreme Court decision really thought serious action was dubious because there could be no bipartisanship. So we'll see that in the first panel before the hearing. But what of some of the other folks who might be speaking on more technical issues that could really show the way forward?
So this is showing the way forward is the great puzzle here. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts invited Congress to do something, but I think Chief Justice Roberts must have been well aware of how hard it is for Congress to do something, because the things that are most likely to be constitutional are the least likely to be politically palatable in this highly polarized Congress. So we'll see if Congress has it in it to figure out something that will both satisfy Chief Justice Roberts and get enough votes for passage.
One of the issues was if you discriminate against certain areas of the country, it's a non-starter for certain members of Congress who aren't going to go for something like that. But could you create a rule which basically says anybody who changes any election rule has to get judicial certification for that, basically make it a 50-state kind of solution?
I think that you could apply this across to 50 states, but my guess is that you couldn't do something as substantial as what existed before. Before, under Section 5, particular jurisdictions had to ask permission of the Department of Justice every single time they changed any voting rule. So that meant something as simple as changing the polling place hours or moving a polling place from one place to another had to be what's called pre-cleared with the Justice Department. And I think that the court would be very reluctant to allow Congress to impose that on all the states. I think that they would find it to be a different kind of violation of federalism, not one of discriminating between the states, which is what they were worried about this round, but of simply putting too heavy a burden. I've proposed, however, a nationwide coverage formula that would be much less burdensome on the states. So it wouldn't require the states to seek permission every time they wanted to make a change, but it would allow civil rights groups and representatives of racial minorities to essentially put in a complaint with the Department of Justice whenever they thought there was a problem.
Like a pre-clearance challenge that you could do before an election. Heather Gerken, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Heather Gerken is a professor at Yale Law School, where she specializes in election law. Thanks to her. And the hearing at the Judiciary Committee takes place today. One of the most amazing stories of the 20th century came to a quiet end last week. Nadezhda Popova died at the age of 91. Now, I don't expect you to know who Popova was unless you are a woman pilot who knows the history of women in aviation in the 20th century or are a student of World War II history. But if you were a German citizen who lived through the air raids of the 1940s, Popova and her fellow pilots were especially feared. The Germans had a name for them.
We flew in sequence, one after another, and during the night we never let them rest. So they called us night witches. And the Germans made up stories. They spread the rumor that we had been injected with some unknown chemicals that enabled us to see so clearly at night.
They were not witches, of course. They were just damn good pilots, the first and only all-women division of pilots in the Soviet Air Force. The witch name came from the sound of their plywood and canvas airplanes bringing to mind squadrons of broomsticks overhead. In 30,000 missions over 4 years, the night witches dumped more than 20,000 tons of bombs on the Germans. Popova herself flew 852 missions.
We never cut the engines. We only idled the engines, and we glided the airplanes. The sound that we made probably made our plane sound like the witch on the broom, but it's just somebody's fantasy.
That's Nadezhda Popova speaking there to the BBC in 2009. It's her life story that sounds like somebody's fantasy, that's for sure. Amy Goodpasture-Strebe, author of Flying for Her Country, The American and Soviet Women Military Pilots of World War II, joins me now. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you.
I mean, what an amazing story. She started out not expected to be a pilot. She stumbled into aviation and is really something of a war hero. How many people like Popova were there in the Soviet Union?
Well, in the Soviet Union, there were about 1,000 women who were parts of the three main regiments, the 588th Regiment, which was the night bombers that Nadezhda Popova was a part of. There was the 587th Regiment, which was the dive bombers, and the 586th, which was the fighter pilots. And those are the three main female regiments that were started by famed Russian pilot Marina Raskova. Some of the women also flew in some of the male regiments, but mainly the Russian women flew in these three main regiments, and there were just a little over 1,000 women who volunteered.
How well known were these women pilots in Germany and during the war as legendary aces and, you know, part of the whole front against Germany?
Well, I think during the time, you know, obviously when they're fighting against each other up in the sky, they don't know that they're fighting against men or women, or, you know, I think the Germans were very surprised when they found out that they were fighting against women. And, of course, there was lots of stories about when some of the Germans been shot down and then they, wanted to know who had been involved with them, and say, in a dogfight or something. And, of course, it ends up being a woman, a Russian woman, a young Russian woman at that. And so they were very surprised. And so they became kind of legendary, I think, during the war. And then, you know, because in Germany, of course, women didn't fly in the Air Force, but in Russia they did. So there was, I think there was a great bit of curiosity towards them, but that in the end, of course, is a great deal of admiration because they had done something that nobody had done, the women had done before. They were the first women to fly in combat.
We're talking with Amy Goodpaster-Strebe, author of Flying for Her Country, The American and Soviet Women Military Pilots of World War II. In the obituary for Nadezhda Popova, it says that these pilots were originally trained as crop dusters in Russia and Ukraine. Is that your understanding?
Well, also you'd understand that the women, the night witches who flew in the 588th Night Bomber Regiment, they flew the PO2s, which were really World War One era biplanes that were made out of wood and canvas, not something that you think you would be flying, you know, against a Luftwaffe. But so they were very precarious. They didn't have parachutes, you know, a lot of the things, you know, radar and anything that sophisticated equipment that you think that you would have. But the good side of the PO2 was that it was highly maneuverable. They could fly very low to the ground. Of course, they flew at night. That's where they did their damage and where they got their nickname, Night Witches. So they were very effective.
I want to play you one other clip that really tells the story of aviation. Nadezhda Popova was born in 1921. She experienced aviation in the very, very beginning as a young girl, and tells this story back in 2009 about seeing a pilot for the first time quite by accident who sort of crash-landed near where she lived in the Ukraine. Listen.
We all rushed out of the school and we saw him landing and he jumped out of the cockpit. We touched his jacket. We touched his hands probably. We thought that the men who were flying were absolutely extraordinary, as if they were coming from another planet. And my dream was not only to fly, but to man the plane myself, to fly like a bird.
You can hear that young girl, even in her voice in 2009. And I'm wondering if a lot of young girls had that experience, and did they get to fly in World War II because of some moment of feminism that went into the military, or just need?
Well, I think definitely was need. There was in the 20s and 30s, the 30s considered like the golden age of aviation. But, you know, in the 20s with Charles Lindbergh, and there was a lot of romance, I think, tied up in aviation because it was in its infancy. And the thought of getting into a plane and flying and the freedom of that brought, I think, really drew a lot of, obviously, men, but women, too, both in the United States and in Russia and all over the world. So, you know, especially Nadezhda being born in a small town in the Ukraine where it wasn't probably too often where planes would be flying around. It was a big deal when a plane would fly into your town. So, but no, I think it definitely wasn't a feminist motivation that brought the women into World War II to fly military aircraft. I think it was definitely a need. Russia, of course, was invaded by Germany, and they needed, you know, every single person to help in the war effort. And so the Russian, you know, thousands of women volunteered to fly. And Marina Raskova, of course, wanting to do her part, too, was able to, with Stalin's blessing, create these three female regiments. And so they basically didn't really think of themselves as doing any different job than what their male counterparts were doing during the war.
And Nadezhda Popova was one of the first to volunteer. Well, it's a remarkable chapter of World War II history, remembering pilot, one of the night witches, Nadezhda Popova, who died last week at the age of 91. Speaking with Amy Goodpaster-Strebe, author of Flying for Her Country, The American and Soviet Women Military Pilots of World War II. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Once upon a time, you could name a year in just a few notes. Here come old flat top, here come grooving up slowly. Name that year. That's 1969, and the albums of the Beatles, the Stones, and Led Zeppelin. That's 1984, Purple Rain and Prince. For me, when I hear this, even for just a couple of seconds, it's back to the summer of 1983, The Police, Synchronicity. All right, I'm that old. But everyone has that album of summer, and some years are bigger for music than others. We'd love to know yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at thetakeaway.org. The public radio music program Soundcheck is having a real nostalgia fest this month about the year 1993. 20 years ago, it turns out, was a monster summer music moment. Soundcheck's host, John Schaefer, joins us in the studio. John, welcome, and take me back, Mr. Schaefer, to 1993.
Ah, that magical summer of 93. These were good times for the record industry. We had big-selling records.
Monster.
It was a great summer for women in music. I mean, Mariah Carey, of course. Janet Jackson had an album that debuted at number one and was a strong seller throughout the summer. Tuesday Night Music Club, Sheryl Crow. This was the album that put Sheryl Crow on the map.
And where is she now? Liz Phair. Man, that was a fresh sound in 93.
Liz Phair's Exile in Guyville. And you said, where are they now? Well, you know, Liz is still making records. But boy, that was a shot across the bow of the music industry back in 1993.
There was a lot of artist beginnings in 93. There were a lot of artist peaks in 93. Tell me about this next selection, which I think is particularly interesting.
Well, what you had was a kind of changing of the guard in the rock world, where the 80s bands, the new wave heroes, were beginning to see the end of their time, and they were beginning to be replaced by what would come to be known as alternative rock. So 1993, although the band would reform many years later, is really the end for the 80s heroes New Order.
You know what I like about this is it feels so 80s, but when that album came out, you really felt like New Order was here to stay forever.
Yep.
And in fact, so much was about to change after 1993 on so many levels in the record industry.
You had Nirvana releasing their album In Utero in the summer of 93. But
Monster.
The summer of 93, we were all, if you were listening to rock radio, we were still listening to last year's record from Pearl Jam.
For so many people, this album, even though it came out earlier...
Came out earlier, yeah.
It says summer. It says summer of 93.
Yeah, and it's not the song so much as... Do you remember the video? Pearl Jam has not done a lot of videos, but they did this super controversial video for the song Jeremy, you know, with a school shooting, as it turns out, at the end. Big story. And, one of the major stories of the summer of 93 was... Hey, here's Pearl Jam finally doing a video, and look at it. It's got this really bloody conclusion. And that brings me to one of the other points about the summer of 93. We're still, as a culture, kind of monolithic, you know? MTV is playing music videos. We're all watching the same things. We're all hearing the same songs on the radio. The kind of fragmentation, the balkanization of pop culture hadn't happened yet.
You know, the other thing that hadn't happened yet was hip-hop wasn't quite ubiquitous. I mean, now hip-hop is everywhere. It's the sort of distinctive signature of American music. Mm-hmm. It certainly wasn't in 1993, and here's an example. My people kept beeping. Now it's time for me to make my impression felt. So sit back, relax, and strap on your seatbelt. You've never been on a ride like this before. With a producer who can rap and control the maestro at the same time with the... Gauge the significance of this release.
Well, The Chronic is important not only for making Dr. Dre as a kind of solo artist and producer famous, but for introducing us to the guy known back then in 93 as Snoop Doggy Dogg. Now, Snoop Dogg, Snoop Lion, the man of many
brand.
Names.
And a brand way, way beyond music. And Dre would introduce us to Eminem and so many other voices later
but,
on.
But this song, Nothing But a G-Thang, big summer song in 1993 for Dr. Dre. You're right, John. There was it was a big year for hip-hop. In fact, on Soundcheck recently, our colleagues at NPR Music came in and told us that 1993 was the greatest year for rap.
Do you buy that?
I don't. You know, I think it sort of depends on what year you were 14.
Well, but here's another example if you want to push that argument.
party over there. Wave your hands in the air, shake the dairy, yeah. These three words mean you're getting busy. Whoop, that is Hitman.
Now, I was out of the country in 93 when
but
this...
But you still couldn't escape this song,
could
you?
That's probably true. That's true. That is definitely true.
I mean, this thing, this is what I'm talking about, the monolithic nature of our culture back then. Didn't matter if you listened to urban radio. You heard this song everywhere. It was a punchline on sitcoms. It was sung slash chanted at sporting events. You could not escape. Whoop, there it is. From this group called Tag Team, which, you know, this wasn't the Atlanta rap that we would later come to know, but they were rappers from Atlanta.
How would we even assemble an argument for what is the best year for albums, the best summer of, you know, blank for music? It's interesting. NPR goes there all the time, but
right.
But how do you gauge it?
You can't. And in fact, one of the things we've done in the past on Soundcheck is we've had neuroscientists come in and tell us about how when you are 14, 15, 16, that's when the plasticity of your brain is at its highest and when you're really soaking in the culture and the music of your time. And that's a formative time on many levels. But in terms of your musical taste, you know, whatever year hits you in that sweet spot, when you were 14, 15, 16, that's going to be the best year for music for you.
When were you 14 out there? Call us at 877-8MYTAKE. Tell us the story of what your greatest summer album year is. Soundcheck's host, John Schaefer, thanks so much.
John, good to see you.
Soundcheck is produced by WNYC. It airs on WNYC right here in New York and on WDET in Detroit. Log on to soundcheck.org to learn more.
Kelly in Seattle, and in the summer of 93, I was listening to Hey Jealousy by the Gin Blossoms. Tell me, did you think it'd be all right
if I could just crash here tonight? Hey, So Is My Wife. That's number 95 on the Billboard 100 of 93. Just to give you an idea of who I am, I was wasting my time with number 38 on the Billboard list, the band PM Dawn, Looking Through Patient Eyes. Whatever it is I do, I try to think about you. I have a love for you, but nothing hides. Oh, I was so hip, yeah. What songs played on your 1993 soundtrack? We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. You feel the love I have yet to find. I know it's there, I know it's there, but I let the sandcastles kill my mind.